I remember my first death call. Well, that's not completely accurate. I remember parts of my first death call. In fact, I'm sure that if I were to relive it, I would realize that I really didn't remember my own personal discomfort. Discomfort was probably so intense that my anxiety was through the roof. What's nice about death calls is that there isn't much work up to them. They just happen, and the chaplain just responds. Well, wait, let me back up for a minute and set it up. I had just started my first unit of clinical pastoral education, CPE. They train ministers by putting them in a hospital for a year. This was at Methodist Le Bonheur Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee. It's a series of hospitals. And the chaplain on call slept in the hospital, was on call for 24 hours, and would service all five hospitals, one of which is a pediatric hospital. I was shadowing a chaplain. It was my first time on call. I wasn't in charge. I was learning. I was at dinner with the experienced chaplain resident, John, and we were talking when the pager went off. John didn't mind death calls, but he didn't really want to do one at Le Bonheur Children's Medical Center either. I don't remember if John was one of those, but I know of some chaplains that would go through that entire year of CPE and never have to go to a child's death at Le Bonheur. I could see his heart sink when he got the page. See, we knew the numbers, and we knew where it came from. It was a different kind of story, though. See, all deaths at a hospital, at this hospital, were tragic, but not all were chaotic. This one was both. We got the call that a girl had died. We learned she'd been dead for quite a while, and for some reason, the next of kin had not been notified. Her mother and father, a young couple, walked with John and I through the empty hall at almost midnight. Our shoes clacked in time, and the sterile silence of the hospital haunted us. There were so many things I didn't understand. I didn't understand why it had taken so long for her to get her mother there, and why the body was already bagged, and why there were 50 people in a large room waiting for their return. I learned a lot in that walk. I learned that hospitals do go silent. Shoes make a lot of noise. And that this child's aunt and grandmother were dying across the street at the medical center because cars and trains don't mix. And as I groped for the right thing to say, you know, the thing that makes it all better, I learned I wasn't ready for this. So for the next year, I searched for the right answer, the perfect script, the words that would fix it all. Thankfully, I'm not alone when it comes to religious stories about people who were afraid they bit off more than they could chew. This year, on March 11th, the Jewish people will begin celebrations for Purim. It begins on the 14th day of Adar. It's considered a lesser holiday, but comes with an amazing story. There was a woman named Vashti. Her husband was the king. And in the Bible, I've always heard him called Xerxes. Xerxes appears in the movie 300, played by Rodrigo Santoro. And when he showed up on the screen for the first time, the group of seminary students sitting there looked up and said, "Oh, Esther's husband." But the guy from the movie only makes sense at the beginning of the story in the Hebrew Bible. See, in the beginning of the story, the king of the Persian Empire is traveling all around his kingdom. The Hebrew Bible says that it was from India to Kush. He had massive parties, which all seemed to make sense with the movie The 300. And the movie, and if the movie is right, they were considerably decadent parties. Which brings us to Vashti, his wife, who apparently didn't care for these parties. So she had the wives over for parties of her own. One night, after much imbibing, the partying Xerxes called upon his wife to put on her crown, to come out to the party and to strut for the men. She disagreed as to the appropriateness of this request and declined, and apparently it didn't go well to decline the king. This book in the Hebrew Bible talks frequently about the Persian legal system. It almost seems like an ancient version of law and order. The first place the book mentions the legal system, it's about how they deal with a queen who doesn't do as she's told. More specifically, who doesn't come when she's called. The nobility in ancient Persia were afraid this would spread to other women in the court, and they couldn't abide uppity women not doing as they're told. So she was put away and replaced. This is where Mordecai comes in. He's raising his niece Esther. Mordecai and Esther lived in Susa. Their family had lived there since the time of Nebuchadnezzar, when he carried King Jehoiakim into exile. Mordecai encourages his niece to hide her lineage, to hide her faith, so that she may become more palatable, so that she may become the new queen. There was a beauty contest, and Esther won. No one ever knowing she was Jewish, she became queen of Persia. We read this in the second chapter of Esther, and the chapter goes on to give some side information on the character Mordecai. Apparently, Mordecai revealed a plot by two guards to assassinate the king. And this is important later in the story. Of course, I'm not going to get to that part of the story, so you'll have to read it for yourself. Because right now I've got to tell you about Haman. Haman became very important in a very important part of the court. He reveled in his own self-importance. He wallowed in it. He demanded that all kneel before him, to which Mordecai, as the NIV puts it, refused to comply, for he was Jewish and not permitted to do so. This did not go well. Haman was a little angry, and let's say everything escalated quickly. This is what the book of Esther says. Then Haman said to King Xerxes, There is a certain people dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom who keep themselves separate. Their customs are different from those of other people, and they do not obey the king's laws. It is not in the king's best interest to tolerate them. If it pleases the king, let a decree be issued to destroy them, and I will give 10,000 talents of silver to the king's administrators for the royal treasury. The king gave his signet ring to Haman. And the Hebrew Bible says it this way: dispatches were sent by couriers to all of the king's provinces with orders to destroy, kill, and annihilate the Jews, young and old, women and children. On a single day, the 13th day of the 12th month of Adar, and to plunder their goods, a copy of the text of the edict was to be issued as law in every province and made known to the people of every nationality so that they would be ready for that day. What kind of man has such a thin skin that such a small light encourages genocide? However, this story would probably not appear in the Hebrew scripture if the plan went through as it was organized. But how? How did they stop the plan? This was already deemed appropriate by the king. The legal system had already decided this genocide would take place. Over the time since Esther had become queen, Xerxes' heart softened. At least where Esther was involved. And now Esther, who had been hiding her genealogy at the request of her uncle, must make a decision. Mordecai tears his clothes and puts on sackcloth, covers himself with ashes, and wails in the heart of the city until Esther comes to him. Mordecai reminded Esther that she was a Jew and she must speak out, that she would not be able to remain hidden. It's said more poetically in the book of Esther when it says, "Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to your royal position for a time such as this?" The book says, "Then Esther sent a reply to Mordecai, 'Go, gather all the Jews who are here in Susa. Fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my attendants will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish.'" Breaking the law to do what's right is a common theme in this book. Vashti broke the law and was put out. Mordecai broke the law and was denounced and prepared for genocide. Esther, knowing these things, will now break the law and approach the king unrequested. You see, the law didn't stop them from making the moral decisions. The story gets really good from here. Esther has a plan, and once that plan starts to unveil, Haman's luck turns. And in the end, Esther has the opportunity to say this thing to both Xerxes and Haman. "If I have found favor with you, your majesty, and if it pleases you, grant me my life. This is my petition. And spare my people. This is my request. For I and my people have been sold to be destroyed, killed, and annihilated." I like the ending. It's a perfect romantic comedy type ending. Well, a romantic comedy if it were written by the Brothers Grimm. But I will never forget all of my life what was instilled in me as a child when I first heard this story. "And who knows that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this?" I remember my last death call, at least the one in that year of residency. A year later from my first, a young woman came in on a stretcher. Her family followed, over a dozen people in the waiting room, and a 3-year-old girl. She wouldn't mind. She wouldn't behave. She wanted and needed attention. Sadly, it was her mother that was sick. I sat down in front of her, talked as much as one can with a 3-year-old. Then she climbed on my lap and laid against my stomach. Later, when we knew that the mother would not come out again, I was holding this child and was asked to take her to see her mom one last time. This was the family's request, and it met considerable opposition from the staff. But the family, her grandmother specifically, was insistent that she see her mother. So I carried her into ER room 2 to say goodbye. I was still holding her when the doctor came out after calling the time of death. I now knew something it took blood and death to learn. Sometimes there is no right answer. And often there is no right choice. At my best, all I could do was try to make the best choice I could with the information I had. Because even though there may not have been a right choice, there were obvious plenty of wrong choices. So I learned to avoid the wrong choices. This child would grow up without a mother, and nothing would fix that. No word, no script, and no answer. I have so many stories like that that it makes me consider Mordecai's words. And who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this. I have too many times seen been the last ear, the last handshake, the last prayer, to ignore the importance of such things. But I know if I was, but I don't know if I was there because I was fated to be. Maybe I was, and it was God who wanted me there. Maybe Allah demanded it of my ear, and maybe Hashem directed my path. Maybe. Seriously, maybe the spirit of life needed a representative. Of course, maybe, just maybe, I was only there because it was my job, and I chose to be. I don't think those things are mutually exclusive. Because in hindsight, I can say very clearly, I was there because I was a Unitarian Universalist. There may be a time in our lives where Mordecai's words come alive. Do not think because you are in the king's house, you are alone. You alone will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. And then I remember that I am UU. On February of this year, UU Church in Denver created a sanctuary for an immigrant who was going to be deported. She lives there to this day. Since 1973, we've supported the LGBT movement, including marriage. We claim Susan B. Anthony. We claim Michael Servetus. We rejected the Nicene Creed, and we like Origen and Clement of Alexandria when they said, we liked them when they said that God would never condemn anyone to hell. And we claim the man who said, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to proclaim the good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom from the prisoners and recovery of sight to the blind, to set the opposition free." And I remember before King said he'd been to the mountaintop, he proclaimed that if he could live at any time in history, he would choose to live in the days he did. And he says this. Now that's a strange statement to make because the world is all messed up. The nation is sick. Trouble is in the land. Confusion all around. There is a strange statement. That's a strange statement, but I know somehow that only when it's dark enough can you see the stars. And I see God working in this period of the 20th century in a way that men in some strange way, are responding. Something is happening in our world. The masses of people are rising up, and wherever they are assembled today, whether they are in Johannesburg, South Africa, Nairobi, Kenya, Accra, Ghana, New York City, Atlanta, Georgia, Jackson, Mississippi, and Memphis, Tennessee, the cry is always the same. We want to be free. And so today, we come here to the Unitarian Universalist Church of Jackson, Mississippi. Maybe we're fated to live in this time of turmoil. I'm not wise enough to know. But I like to think, even if I were fated, that I would choose to be here at this time because it's my job, and my job description is love. Thank you.